am I missing? Also, in addition to all our sponsoring organizations, I do want to thank Rena and Kenny Greenwald for their help in sponsoring of the program. I think they're here. I know I saw them. There they are. Okay, I introduced, now we'll do an introduction of Rav Stav. For those who weren't here on Shabbos, I think one of the nice things I'd like to say, just over the course of Shabbos, he quoted Rav Kook, the Satmar Rebbe, the Netziv, Rav Shach, Rav Soloveitchik. Who else am I missing? All in the course of one shiur. This who was quoted. So, and I think that gives you an indication of the personality. He's really a wonderful personality. He's the Rav of the town of Shoham, 20,000 people in Israel. He, as we mentioned, is also the co-founder of the Yeshivat Hesder in Petah Tikva. Has 9 children, 3 of whom are married. He also one of the members of Tzohar. I believe he teaches at Bar Ilan University, and it's a pleasure to have him here with us, him and Emre Shurlo, and I'll let Elia take over with our panel on issues facing Israel at 60.
I'm going to start this morning with the Hithkat Nut, with the disengagement, and the reason is because Rav Shurlo, in the wake of the Hithkat Nut, wrote the following at the beginning of 2006. In Israel today, you hear two utterly different narratives of the destruction of Gush Katif. The difference is already evident in the name. We religious Zionists call what happened destruction, expulsion, uprooting, racist transfer. An absolute majority of the secular public, however, refer to it as disengagement. We regard the expulsion as a traumatic event whose reverberations will never be forgotten or forgiven, while for the other sector it was an insignificant event, no longer on the agenda. We see it as an act of dictatorship, tantamount to usurpation of government by corrupt, underhand means. But an entire sector of the public sees it as a legal democratic act, perhaps rather crooked, but such are the ways of democracy. We feel that our disproportionate contribution to the army and elsewhere has gone unrecognized and has earned us no gratitude, whereas the others feel that we have trampled everything that they value and hold sacred. These two narratives are the real threat to the state of Israel, that each side is immersed in its own narrative without understanding that of the other side, clearly heralds an imminent rupture, unquote. It's 2 years later now. How do you feel about this these remarks? I'm wondering, is there a, quote, imminent rupture that is taking place or about to take place in Israel between those that see settlement of the land, all of the land, as the paramount raison d'etre of Zionism versus those who not only do not share these values but see them as dangerous or possibly even fanatical? Are we looking at an Israel that is fractured in the most basic of ways?
Principally, nothing was changed. I think if I had to write the same things today in the middle of the 2008, I would have write the same things. The problem is, and I'm concerned is that there's a third narrative. And this is the largest narrative, and that is confusion. Because I think today the majority in Israel are very, very confused. Even those that supported the Hitnatkut, the disengagement, see what's happening in the Gaza Strip, and Sderot, the rocketing, and they understand that everything they thought that will happen after a kind of withdrawal, and destroying Hitnachluyot, his settlements, and etc., is not promising peace, is not promising anything. I would say the opposite. Many of those that are supporting a kind of a withdrawal agreement with the Palestinians realize that actually what will happen one day after withdrawn from the West Bank is that the Hamas will take place and things would get worse and not better. So the confusion of the majority in Israel is, I think, is really escalating, because the old fashion of solutions means if there'll be a withdrawal, we'll achieve peace, probably collapsed, but they don't support the itnachluyot, they don't feel, they see them as obstacles towards peace, and they are, as I said, confused. Now, therefore, my point is that today I think that in Israel there are three groups. One, let's call it the Zionist religious movement, the entire, I'm not talking about everyone because we are very split and there are a lot of opinions, but mostly the Zionist religious movement supports the settlements in Yehuda Shomron and really feel very negative feelings towards the state regarding the disengagement and becoming even more right-wing extreme ideology. There is a minority, we are a minority, there is a minority that says the old world words that in order to achieve peace you have to withdraw, to go back to the 67 boundaries, the borders, and to come in a kind of agreement with the Palestinians. But I think that the majority in Israel, we are celebrating the 60th anniversary, the real atmosphere in Israel about this issue is confusion.
Okay. Let me just pick up on something you said at the end of what you were talking about, and I want to quote for you a recent interview given by the Prime Minister, in which he said in his defense of his desire to find a two-state solution, which would obviously involve, in his opinion, West Bank withdrawal, he says, at the end of the day, it's about demography. If the day comes when the two-state solution collapses and we face a South African struggle for equal voting rights, then as soon as that happens, the state of Israel is finished. He goes on to say the Jewish organizations, which were our power base in North America, will be the first to come out against us because they will say they cannot support a state that does not support democracy and equal voting rights for all its citizens. So the Prime Minister is obviously raising the specter of ultimately whether Israel can maintain a kind of Jewish and democratic bent at the same time, that ultimately this will be put to the final test. I'm wondering how you feel about this.
So I'll continue. I think the Prime Minister is right. It's a great problem. But I don't think that the withdrawal from the West Bank, from Yehuda Shomron, will solve it. The people will be there, the demographic issue will continue. And as we see towards the Gaza Strip, even will we be responsible, not only, the Palestinians, let's say we made a huge withdrawal and we went back to the 67 boundaries. They don't have an airport, they don't have a port, they don't have any way of existing as a state. So therefore, we'll continue to be responsible and we'll be blamed that we are isolating, that the discrimination and racism, whatever, but everything that is happening in the Gaza Strip today. So therefore, the problem that the Prime Minister raises is a real problem. Everybody that is aware what's happening in Europe, and switching, and even in the Palestinian Authority, that the main may really demand and want the one-state solution, and will refuse to have a two-state solution. It can happen, and it's happening. But the idea that the withdrawal from the Gaza Strip from Yehuda Shomron will solve this problem, I think it's incredible. I want to say another one thing. I think that more and more people realize that it's not a controversial issue about territories, and it's not about about interests. It's becoming a cultural and spiritual dispute between Islam and Yadut and whatever, that I think it's really very naive to think today that a withdrawal will solve the problem.
I would like to add to the... Yeah. I would like to make one more comment regarding what Rav Shalom was saying now. I guess most of you visit Israel very often, and I guess you have seen, if you have visited the Galil, you could see that many Arabs live there. I personally, with a few rabbis, we have good connections with a few of their leaders, but we shouldn't misunderstand what's going on. I mean, most of the Galil is settled by Arabs, and there was a poll last week that asked the Israelis, do you think that we'll have to put a fence in the Negev? And more than 40% of the Israelis believe that it will not take time, a long time, that we will have to be establish a kind of a separation fence in the middle of the Negev, because the Bedouin that are growing there could think that they could have a kind of independence or a kind of autonomy, and they will demand that. And once we withdraw from Judea and Samaria, the understanding of our citizens, of our Arab citizens that used to live in Israel before the 67 war, they will realize that it's only a kind of question of time until they will be able to cause us to disappear from this place. So I would have said that it's a very big headache, the problem in Gaza and the problem in Judea and Samaria. But the solution for headache is not cutting off the head. It's understanding that we have a great headache and we have to confront it and to live with it.
I'm just thinking about those last few words. To confront it and to live with it have two different implications. I'm hearing both of you talk about what is wrong thinking. So I'm curious what would be right thinking here. In other words, if you would be in charge, how would this problem be confronted?
Well, first, I'm lucky that I'm not in charge.
That's true.
And I didn't choose the job to be in charge of these issues. And it's very easy to criticize from this chair, especially in Toronto, and not replacing the Prime Minister. But to say the truth is that there isn't one political leader that is ready to tell the people the truth. I'm sorry to say that most of the leaders, I don't want to say all of them, but I would rather say all of them. I mean, the candidates that ran for being Prime Minister don't tell the people the truth. Like Churchill told to his people during the World War II. They are not ready to say to the people, look, we tried everything and there is no solution. Not on the right wing, not on the left wing. We have no solution. We have to make a lot of efforts to bring more Jews to this place. We have to make a lot of efforts to strengthen our economy. We have to make a lot of efforts to strengthen our education. By the way, we have to know regarding the demographic situation that there are different opinions among the experts. What is the real situation? Do we have positive or negative immigration regarding the Arabs from Judea and Samaria? Because many experts say that many Arabs leave that these areas. Others claim that it's not true. What I'm trying to say is that politicians and we as rabbis, especially, we ought to educate ourselves, and not only our children, as Rav Shlomo said before, that there is a very well-known expression that, I don't know if Rav Kook said it or not, but it fits to his ideology to say that Am HaNetzach, a nation that belongs to the eternity, is not afraid from a long way. And we have to understand that we have yet a long way to go. I must tell you a story, a short story. 15 years ago, I was a shaliach. I was a shaliach in Antwerp. And Rav Shlomo Aviner came to visit us. And I asked him to describe his Rosh Yeshiva in the old city in Yerushalayim. And I asked him to describe the buying, the Jews that buy houses from the Arabs in the Islamic quarter in East Jerusalem, in the ancient city. And he described how here they buy one house and another house. So one of the students asked him, what would you estimate, Rav Avinel, how long would it take you to buy all the houses from the Arabs that live in this quarter, the Islamic quarter of ancient Jerusalem. So Rav Aviner says in a very serious face, oh, it will be very quick. I think not more than 300 years. And this is the kind of answer that I expect from our politicians to teach us that struggles in Eretz Israel, we don't sit with a watch to seek for a solution in 1 year, in 10 years. We ought to understand that Shivat Zion is not something that takes 1 year or 10 years. It will take many years until the Jewish people will be able to sit to settle in Eretz Israel freely.
I note that one of the things you didn't say there, and I'm raising this because I hear this a lot from other people, there's a frustration, especially people who are on the outside of Israel, that the thought is, what we really need to do is we need to get more aggressive. We need more force, more military. You hear people in communities, especially those more on the right, saying they go in but they don't finish the job. That's the kind of language that gets used. But I noticed that you didn't say that when you were talking about potential solutions. What do you think of that notion, that what's really lacking here is simply to be more aggressive militarily?
Well, first, as I said before, I'm not the expert and I'm not in charge on it, and I'm not the one to give advice to the government. I think it's not a question of being aggressive or not. It's a part of the confusion that Rav Sherlo has described a few minutes ago. The government tried to be very aggressive 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And the government found out that after the first 100 soldiers that were killed in the war, in the Second Lebanese War, the entire climate in Israel was changed. And all the journalists that encouraged the government to go to an aggressive war against the Hezbollah, all of a sudden changed their mind. This kind of phenomena happened to occur in the States in the first year when the Americans attacked Iraq. Most of the journalists and most of the population encouraged the administration. And after the victims of this war, and I'm not saying a word against or for this war, I'm just saying what happened in and leaders are acting under pressure of public opinion, and they get telephones and they get mails from their citizens, from their voters, and I realize that this kind of solution, for instance, I must tell you, I as a father to a son that is an officer in the paratroops and is supposed to be in Gaza in next month with his soldiers, I can tell you that I, as declaring wing side in the political map in Israel, that I'm so enthusiastic about the opening a war in Gaza. All the experts estimate that it will not end with less than 300, 400 soldiers that will be killed there. I'm not sure that this is the solution. And who guarantees us that after we will make the job and we will clean off the area from the Hamas and from the rockets, and we will have to withdraw because no one wants to govern 1.5 million and to take care of their needs in Gaza. I'm not referring to the uprooting of the settlers in Gush Katif, but I'm referring to the people that live in Gaza, in the district of Gaza. No one wants to govern there, and no one wants to be there. And who can guarantee that after we leave that, it will not happen again, like what happened in Lebanon last year? So I'm not the one to give advice to the government. I'm sure that the way they run it now is a part of the confusion, a part of the fact that they are afraid from what will be the reaction of the public if we don't win the war so fast with a low price of victims. So I'm not in the position to give advice. I'm sure that we cannot succeed in this way, and this situation that we are in the current time cannot last for a long time.
I don't know about you. This is about the time I start to get depressed. But I wanted to take it back
One of my rabbis used to say, it happened
I think 25 years ago, there was a kind of underground in Hebron that killed, without authority of the government, that killed a few leaders that were deserved their killing. I mean, they were not Hasidei Umot HaOlam, but it was without the authority of the government. So when they came to the Rosh Hashiva, to one of these rabbis, he said to them the following: look, if you want to live in Hebron, you must be relaxed. If you are nervous, don't be there. If you want to live in Eretz Israel and to survive, you must be relaxed. You must breathe deeply and not getting frustrated from every headline that you will see in paper. Because if you will get frustrated or depressed from every headline, and we see the headline in Israel every day, you can be in very, very bad shape. You can end by the psychiatrist. So it's better to be relaxed in that.
There are some people in Israel I want to have you talk to. I want to go back to talk about the fallout within the religious Zionist community from the Hitkatnut, and probably earlier, really. The Hitkatnut was really, I think, in some ways, long in coming in terms of that kind of split. One hears a lot of discussion, both orally and in writing, about the alleged sort of disillusionment of certain segments of the religious Zionist community after the Hitkatnut took place. We even heard stories of religious Zionist youth disenchanted with their own leadership, with the rabbinic authority in general, even with God. I'm wondering how representative are such anecdotes, and is there a kind of crisis of vision in this movement that it's currently undergoing, and where do you see its future directions?
I'll summarize the facts, and then analyzing the facts we can disagree about it. The facts are the following. The Zionist religious movement is very, very, very splitted today. Every indicator can show it, can prove it. I'll give five examples very briefly. There are five different parties that are searching after voters only from the Tzionut HaDatit. I'm not talking about Kadima and about Likud. I'm talking about Zionist religious parties like Mafdal and people that left Mafdal and Tkuma and Moledet and Meimadet, whatever. There are five youth movements, at least five, but three large ones, Bnei Akiva and Ezra and Ariel and whatever. There are tens, more, dozens of education networks in Petah Tikva itself. You know, the very famous author, Uri Orbach, he wrote, a journalist, everybody establishes a school where he's asking himself, with whom my son will not learn together. You understand that? And there are rabbis, there are really controversial issues that we can't agree about many, many, many things. I'm not talking about only politics, direct politics, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the question is how to analyze it. Some people say it's a disaster, and this is the slippery slope that will bring the Zionist religious movement to disappear. And disappear means that approximately a third of us will become more Haredim and more connected to the maybe less than third, maybe quarter, and three quarter will come, you know, will assimilate in the entire state of Israel in all kinds of ways, and therefore we will not be able to deliver the special message of Tzionut Datit. Some other people claim the opposite. It's not a crisis. It's thriving. That's the meaning of thriving. All kinds of ways, all kinds of... there's no authority. The people think by themselves. There are autonomy. And they no intimidation anymore. Nobody is under pressure. And that's very good that we are, you know, getting involved in all the society. And we have all kinds of ideas and all kinds of way of thinking, and here and there, and so everybody can choose what is the real analyze. I can say one thing, and that is very important. And that is that in order to read the map, you should be very careful reading the map through the extreme movements or left and right. Because usually there are much more interesting people and much more interesting ideas you can read when people are in the edges. You know, the mainstream is boring. It's boring. And people that are in the edges are much more attractive. And edges, I mean, right and left. So therefore, sometimes we, if we'll find a 10, 12 years old girl, 14 years old girl that didn't recognize didn't agree to come to court and to discuss with the judge something, and were in jail for 3 months, and a few girls admired her, and etc., people can read the map and can think, oh, now the whole Zionist religious movement is opposing the state, is changing, is becoming more Haredi, etc., etc. Don't make this mistake. The mainstream is the mainstream, and you should read the map through the mainstream, or trying to understand the trends and the transition of opinions. But the mainstream of the Zionist religious movement is, I think the right thing to say is the following. There is a lot of confusion also in the mainstream of the Zionist religious movement. All of us, I think, or most of us, I can't say all of us, are becoming more to the right. Regarding Yom HaTzma'ut, Medinat Israel, we must understand, I think I need two more minutes. We must understand that our kids are completely different from us. They didn't see, I'm talking about 20, 25 years old. They didn't see anything heroic from the State of Israel in the past 25 years. We saw the Six Days War. We saw the Entebbe operation. We saw Maccabi Tel Aviv, the final, but the first time that Maccabi Tel Aviv got was the championship of basketball. We saw all kinds of these issues. We had lovely experience in Medinat Israel. Our kids are growing up with what they've met is, first of all, a state, regular state with debating, with corruption, with negative things. They saw the Oslo process, they saw the disengagement, they saw all those issues, and they saw the Second Lebanon War that, as you know, wasn't a great victory, and et cetera, et cetera. And when they grow up in this, under these circumstances, so their attitude towards Medinat Israel, and definitely we are children of parents that went over the Shoah, or at least our generation is the second generation. They are the third generation, and Yom HaShoah doesn't take a great place today in Medinat Israel. They are not under these feelings. So therefore, thank God, things became normal. Thank God, Israel is a normal state with a lot of discussions, but the heroic attitude and the feeling, that deep feeling towards Medinat Israel, should be understood. Things will change, and therefore we should understand that in order to recreate those feelings towards Medinat Israel, we have to do a lot of things that for us was obvious, but for our children are something that we have to deal with.
I would like to add to what Shelo said, that I disagree with the way that Rav Shelo said that it's only question, or it we could have heard from Rav Shelo, it's only question of ages. It's not only ages. Mm-hmm. Researchers show that even in the population that lives in among Tel Aviv and Ranana and Shoham, for instance, I will take the case of the girls that did not recognize the authority of the court and set in jail for a few months. It's true that it's only seven girls. So this is the hard circle of the girls that don't recognize the authority of the court. But the fact was that they got support not only from their families or from the settlement they live, but they got support from the people that live in Shoham and Ra'anana and elsewhere. And more people feel that they don't have faith in the government's institutions. researches that were made recently show that among the mainstream of the religious Zionist society, they celebrate Yom HaTzmaut. That's a kind of consensus, but it starts in Yom HaTzmaut. It will start in the Memorial Day for Chayalei Tzal, but I guess this consensus will end on Thursday night when the celebrations for the anniversary, for the 60th anniversary, will end. Because the day after, or the day later, regarding every institute that we have in Israel, the dispute regard to this institute will start. I will give a few examples. What is our attitude to the Supreme Court? What is our attitude to the army?
Police?
What is our attitude to the municipality, to the police? All researchers show that even among the mainstream of the society, they have less and less faith.
Confidence.
They have less and less confidence in these institutes. And this is a kind of a danger to our society. Because to differentiate between our attitude to the state and our attitude to the army, between the attitude to the miracle that of the existence of the state and the frustration and the disappointment from the government's behavior is something that belongs to the yeshiva guy in a shiur, and it's not something that you can explain to a youngster that is 12 or 14 years old. Rav Shlomo mentioned that our youngsters were not aware to the victories or to the heroic events that occurred in Israel's history. They are not aware to the negative events that took place in Israel's history. When I come to talk to youngsters and I teach them what happened in Israel a few months after the establishing of the State of Israel, the story of Altelena, the story of what happened to the kids that immigrate from North Africa or from Tehran to Eretz Israel, what did the government do to these kids? What kind of education? How they took them from their parents, or they took them from religious education, and they put them in other places, in the kibbutzim, or in the public school, the public secular schools. And I try to compare these events to the event of Gush Katif, of the uprooting from Gush Katif, or the disengagement. I used the term disengagement yesterday, and I got a few comments why I used this term here. So I chose another term, uprooting, which is neutral, I think. It's not exiling, but it's uprooting. And I ask them to ask their parents or to ask their rabbis that tell them that this is the worst event that ever occurred in Eretz Israel under the government of the State of Israel. And I want them to compare what is worse, to take hundreds of thousands of students, of youngsters, and to put them in public school and to force them not to observe mitzvot, or to take 10,000 people from their houses. I don't know what is worse. Well, I know what is worse. To force someone to be not frum is much worse than to accept a political decision that I oppose this specific decision, but still it's a kind of a political legitimate decision. And what is not legitimate is to force someone to send his son to a place where he doesn't want to do that. And still, all the Zionist rabbis, after all what they have seen in the behavior, in the misbehavior of our government, they still said Hallel in Yom HaTzmaut, and they still understood that this is a part of the process of our redemption. And I guess they didn't admire the Prime Minister for his behavior, but the attitude for the personality or for the behavior of a certain government or a certain prime minister did not affect their attitude to the establishing or to the existence of a Jewish state in our time. this difference and this complexity is not so simple to grow upon. Most of our children grew up on the background of Milchemet Shesht HaYamim. We won and we conquered or we released Eretz Israel, and now the government wants to give up everything, and such a government is a kind of a disaster for the existence of the State of Israel, and this government symbolizes the State of Israel. So if we are opposing the government's policy, so we have to oppose the existence of Medinat Israel. And people are not so clear, and it's very hard to educate, to differentiate between a current decision of a government and the existence and the establishment of the State of Israel.
I'm hearing both of you talk in terms that are, you know, somewhat cautious. You're basically stressing that you have to have a nuanced, sophisticated view. I think it's interesting to consider the first ideological platform of Gush Emunim and compare it to what the two of you are talking about. That platform reads that the goal is to bring about a great movement of awakening in the nation of Israel in order to realize the Zionist vision in its entirety, with an awareness that the source of this vision is the Jewish tradition and the roots of Judaism. Its goal is complete redemption for the nation of Israel and the entire world. I guess I would ask you, do these goals still exist, and are they achievable?
Definitely there exists, and even more than that. Even what I spoke an hour ago about the family, that this is not, seems that it's not connected to Gush Emunim, it's very connected. From my point of view, Gush Emunim, the great success of Gush Emunim is not related only to the settlements and to Eretz Israel. We grew up as kids, I'm talking about 1965, there is a very famous author in Israel, Amos Oz, maybe the famous, he wrote that our self-identity was that we are, I'll say it in Hebrew, Mashgiach HaKashrut, the Kashrut Observer, Bikron HaMisada, in the restaurant coach of Rakevet HaTzionut. That means our self-identity was that the train of the Tzionut is secular, is being leaded by the secular people, and our job is, you know, to be the Kashrut inspector in the restaurant coach of this train of the Tzionut. And it really was that way. I remember myself, I was ashamed. I grew up in Herzliya. I didn't go with a kippah. I had a kova tembel. Everybody knows what's a kova tembel, or a kind of a cap. And I admire the few, there were no high-level officers in the army, in religious one, except in the Rabbanut of the army, etc., etc., etc. Now, Gush Emunim, when they spoke to us, we were 17 years old when Gush Emunim was established, they spoke to us in completely different terms. They said, we are going to switch and we are going to move ourselves to be in the first coach of the train and to lead it. Gush Emunim wasn't established after the Six Days War. It's a great mistake, historic mistake that everybody does. Gush Emunim wasn't established after the Six Days War. It was established after the Yom Kippur War, when everybody was depressed, when everybody was with their heads in the ground. So then Gush Emunim was established and said, now we are taking, the leadership of Medinat Israel, and we are raising the proudness of being Zionist religious, part of the Zionist religious movement with glorification of the situation and a message to the whole state. And then we became the increasing wasn't related only to Eretz Israel. We became much more, the yeshivot were established. Most of the yeshivot and the big trend of establishing yeshivot was a result of Gush Emunim, because we were proud of what we are doing and we had self-identity, and therefore we wanted to distribute it. Most of the changes of our self, attitude towards ourselves was completely different. And since then, I think there was the great period of time of thriving of the Zionist religious movement. It was flourish, and the consequences are until today. So therefore, this continues. What was changed is, as I said, I think that we are a little bit more confused, because of two reasons. The first reason is because I want to say it regarding Yom HaTzmaut, we didn't give an answer yet. What do we really want? When Herzl thought about the Zionist movement, he wrote a book, the Altneiland book. And he wrote, what does he want? And if you'll read it, you know, celebrating Yom HaTzmaut and comparing what's happening today in Israel to his book, so he applied 50%, 60% of what he wrote. We didn't write the book yet. We didn't say, what do we really want? You asked before how to solve the problem with the Palestinians. It's a good issue. But we didn't say many other things. What will be the justification system, and what will be the ethics rules, and what will be the public space, what is a democratic Jewish public space, if I'll say that way, whatever. We didn't write it yet. So therefore, first of all, you can't, you know, lead a policy that if you don't know I'm not talking exactly. Nobody knows exactly, but even is our vision. And I think that's one thing that we should do. And until we did it, once we did it, I think we can be much more powerful. But today we don't have it yet. So this is the one thing. The second thing is that we feel that the secular population in Israel was changed, became much more postmodern, much more individual, much less powerful. I'll say the following. To be secular today is much less attractive. Most of our kids, when they decide they don't want to be Orthodox, usually we used to call them datlash. Dati leshavar. You know, they were dati. Today, the phenomenon is datlap. Dati lefamim. That means they say, we don't want to be secular. We don't want to observe all the mitzvahs. So we're choosing, we are doing our way, but they don't demonstrate against the observance, and they don't really shift completely because they want to be... there's nothing really attractive about being secular today in Medinat Yisrael. So therefore, I think that this week is a very good opportunity to remind ourselves that there's a great opportunity today for the Zionist religious movement, and we can do a lot of things. But first of all, we have to sit down and ask ourselves, I'm not talking exactly, but what, you know, principally, we want to create in the state of Israel. Let me apologize for a second. I said in the shiur before that my parents were born in Germany. So therefore, I have the Yekes gene. My flight is at 1:30. I'm under tension. So let me apologize and let me go to the airport. And hopefully, I'll continue. Rav Stav will stay with you, but I'll continue. We'll meet again.
Okay. I would like to add regarding what Rav Shlomo was saying. I would like you to know that recently we see a very interesting phenomena regarding the growing up of the national religious people. I'm not referring to the political crisis that happens in the among the Zionist religious people, which has various reasons for the existence of this crisis, but I'm referring to the people, to the regular people. As a spokesman of the Hesder Yeshivot, I can tell you that we have more than 60 Yeshivot Hesder, which is something that we can't recall when did we have so many yeshivot as we have now. The
the chief of staff has urged us, maybe we can grow slower. Maybe we can do something that we will not open 5-6 yeshivot every year. A week after Yom HaTzmaut, I have to sit in one of the committees of the yeshivot Esder that we have to receive to confirm a few other yeshivot that want to get our confirmation to open. We see more and more religious people, men and women, working in television, in Channel 1, in Channel 2, in Channel 10. We see them more and more in the radio, in the media, all kinds of media. We see them among the high ranks in the army, as what Rav Shelo has mentioned, that when Gush Emunim started, there was almost no high-ranked officer besides the Rabbanut HaTzvait. Now, most of the commanders in the infantries are religious officers. It's a part of this confusion that on one hand, this movement is growing up, it's flourishing, and we see many beautiful results, many Talmidei Chachamim, many authors, many journalists among them. On the second hand, we see a kind of confusion, what should be our attitude to the institutions of the state, what should be our attitude to the non-religious people that we live next to. Actually, we must admit that recently more and more Zionist religious Jews prefer to build their houses far away from the secular neighbors. I'm saying it unfortunately. And this is a part of the crisis, because once you don't grow up with your neighbors, with the secular neighbors, you don't understand them very well. And this causes a kind of gap between you. I must tell you, I told this story to the Ulpena in the Yeshiva Tichonit, and I will repeat this story, because this story, I think, is an example of what happens in Israel in the current time. I am the Rav of a town named Shoham, and I chose to build my house surrounded with non-religious people. 2 years ago, my wife offered me to invite one of our neighbors to see how Bdikat Chametz looks like. And they were very happy with this invitation, and they came to our house. And as it must happen, we found, my children distributed 10 pieces of bread, and I found 9 out of the 10. And my daughter forgot where she put the 10th piece. So all of the children started screaming at her, "Where do you put this piece of bread?" And my neighbor sees that I'm getting nervous, and he knows that usually I'm at least pretending to be relaxed. And all of a sudden he discovers something new about his neighbor that he gets nervous. So he asks me, "Rav David, what is this all about? What's the problem?" So I'm telling him, "Look, we are looking after this 10th piece of bread." So he says to me, "What's the problem? I have plenty of bread in my house. I can give you how many pieces of bread that you need. What's the problem?" Now, you understand that such an answer can come only from someone that has no idea whatsoever about Yiddishkeit, about how a Jewish religious house should look like. And he has no idea about the prohibition of Bal Yirayeh and Bal Yimatzeh. And this could happen, a part of the reason, there are many other reasons, but a part of the reason, because religious people don't live with non-religious people. So they have no idea how religious house behaves on Pesach, how should it look like, I'm not saying that he has to perform this mitzvah by himself, but at least to know what's going on by me. And the same thing occurs to us regarding him. We have no idea about what he thinks, what he needs. And when we come to the situation that we are in a dispute between us, it causes our children, our youngsters that never grew up in circumstances where they met the non-religious neighbor in their neighborhood to misunderstand what he wants, what he needs. And it's a part of the problem that our youth is facing and comes to discover only when they come to the army, and many times even after the army, because a part of them is serving in the SDR and they don't meet the non-religious soldiers even during the army service.
Okay. I wanted to pick up on that issue and maybe close with this question about relationships between secular and religious, because I know that it's one of the real mandates of Tzohar to create dialogue between religious and less observant Jews in Israel. And one of the things that I hear a lot, you know, all of my relatives in Israel are secular, and they have a good deal of animus, a good deal of hostility, actually, towards the religious public. And one of the touchstones for their dislike is politics, especially the Rabbanut HaRashi, the chief rabbinate. And we know recently that there's been a lot of discussion about rabbinic power in areas like conversion, which I was going to talk about with Reb Shurla, but we can speak about it as well. What do you feel about the way that conversions are handled in current day Israel? And in a larger way, how would you address those people who are resentful of the kind of mixture of religious Jews in political maneuvering?
Well, actually, I thought that it's a part of the next speech that I have to hold here in a few minutes. But I will refer to the beginning of your question. I will refer later on to the conversions, because it's a very big topic in our days, especially if you hear the news from Israel recently, the current news. But I would like to refer to the relationship between religious and non-religious people, especially regarding the attitude to synagogues or to Jewish tradition. Something very bad happened to us in Israel during the last 60 years regarding this issue. People, I'm referring especially to the Ashkenazi people, because by the Sfarim it went a bit differently, but people combined between the attitude to the Jewish tradition and to the Jewish rabbinate or to the rabbinical administration. I can tell you that it was more than once, maybe twice, maybe more than three times, that I registered non-religious couples in a coffee house because they said, we are not entering the steps of the Rabbanut. We will not go in this room. We are even willing to register in the rabbinate. They know that the rabbinate of Shoham is very moderate and very nice receiving people, but principally we are not going into the office of the rabbinate. So I asked them, what do you suggest? So they offered, let's go to drink coffee somewhere, and you will register us there. And that's what we have done. People don't go to shuls because of this. And as a result of it, we see that millions of Jews in Israel, since their bar mitzvah, didn't visit a shul. I remember that when I was 12, 14 years old, when I came to shul Shabbos morning, I knew all the news that happened on Friday night, because I had so many neighbors in shul. I won't say when they told me the news, but during davening, during leining, but there wasn't one man or woman that davened, that appeared in shul, that was religious, that didn't know what happened Friday night all over the country. Why? Because the non-religious people that came to daven told us what happened. But now we have no news. Now, the problem is not the news, but the problem is that we don't see them anymore in shul. But not only on Shabbos we don't see them in shul, we don't see them in shul in Yom Kippur, which is something terrible. Now, there are three reasons for them not to appear on Yom Kippur even. And one leads to the other. It starts with the fact that Baruch Hashem, our shuls are growing up. We have many, many children. And there is no room for others. But it's not only a physical room. It's a kind of a spiritual room. We have no room for them. We have no space for them, not only in the shul physically, but we have no space for them in our hearts. Because when we come to shul, most of us, I'm referring to our religious Zionist communities, we come to meet our tribe. There was a movie in Israel called The Fire's Tribe, Medurat HaShevet. I don't know the right translation in English. People come to meet their friends from Bnei Akiva in shul, and they are not willing to open their hearts, and they have no space for the non-religious people. That's one reason. The second reason is because the people, the non-religious people, feel that once they come and they show up in shul, it's a kind of recognition in all the bad things that the rabbinical administration is doing to them the whole year. And they don't want to become a part of this. They hold that what we are doing, that what the administration or what the rabbinate is approaching the whole year is very bad for them, and they are not willing to cooperate with this. And for them to go to shul is a kind of cooperation with the administration or the rabbinate. As a result of that, the children don't know how Siddur looks like. And this leads to another step, that even when they want to come to daven, they don't know how to daven. And there is no gabbai in a religious Zionist shul that will tell the prayers, please open page 81. There isn't such a thing in Israel. And no one will know how to open the Siddur. So for instance, in Tzohar, we opened special minyanim on Yom Kippur a few years ago in neutral places. You don't have to come to shul in order to pray. You can come to a culture house. It sounds like something cultural. Although the davening was a regular davening, with a mechitze, with everything that you need to be a shul. We printed sidurim that have signs where you have to stand. They show a figure of a man that is standing, and where you have to sit, and explanations of what you are reading, because the Hebrew of the Siddur is not so simple. And we stopped davening in the middle of certain paragraphs in order to explain. And people describe it as the first Jewish experience that they have since the Bar Mitzvah. So, but although it's a very nice project, but this is not the solution for the entire state. I mean, we face a situation that the new generation, which is already the third or maybe the fourth generation of being secular, has no idea whatsoever about what Yiddishkeit looks like and how they should approach, how should they get closer to this issue. And I don't want to be the one to accuse someone. I think in these days, in the trend of these days, we should say, Kulanu ashamnu. We are all guilty, because we, the religious ones, could behave in a better way in order to be mekarev of them to shuls, to open our hearts, to open our gates to them. On the second hand, the secular education system doesn't teach nothing about Yiddishkeit. They try to improve something recently, but I'm not saying that it's never too late, but it's very little, and it's very late. And if we will not do immediately if we will not take steps in order to be mekarev these people to our common sources, I think we will face in a few years a problem that a very huge part of the non-religious people in Israel will have no idea whatsoever what he is doing in Eretz Israel, what is his connection to Jewish roots. And if you ask me, if I go back to the beginning of this conversation, what worries me more? The problem, the political problem regarding the Arabs in Judea and Samaria, or Galil, or Negev? I will tell you definitely that what worries me much more is the fact that my neighbor has no idea what is Chametz and what is Bal Yirae and Bal Yimatzeh.
Rav Stav, thank you very much. We're going to take a 5-minute break, and then Rav Stav is going to present his lecture.